Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Care 11, host of care11.com. 24-hour access to updated weather, radar, news, and traffic information. care11.com.
Good morning. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio on this Memorial Day, 2001. I'm Mike Edgerly. Gary Eichten returns tomorrow. Minnesota legislators begin meeting tomorrow in informal conference committees to iron out details of the broad agreement reached with the governor last Friday on tax and spending measures. Work is far from over, though. The details in the tax bill have to be worked out, and seven other spending bills are pending. Once those details are agreed to, Governor Ventura says he will call the legislature into special session for final action on all the legislation. Friday's agreement was seen as a major victory for the governor and the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. The DFLers, which control the Senate, say the agreement doesn't live up to its promise and, in fact, could shortchange schools in the long run. In summary, the deal would eliminate the general education property tax levy, revise the classification system for property taxes, essentially creating a flat rate for homes under $500,000 and a single, slightly higher rate for homes above a half million. Property taxes would decrease for residential properties, businesses, apartments, and farms. Taxpayers this year will also see a sales tax rebate check ranging from $120 at the low end to more than $3,000 on the top end. Joining us to discuss the tax and spending deal and a look ahead to the next few days' legislative action is DFL Senator John Hottinger of Mankato, the Assistant Majority Leader in the Senate. Senator, welcome to Midday.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, and thank you for joining us and taking some time out from your Memorial Day holiday. We expect to be joined a little later by Representative Tim Pawlenty of Eagan, who's the majority leader in the House, and we'll connect with him a little later on. Senator, the first question for you, there were predictions from Majority Leader Roger Moe that, in fact, this deal is not such a good deal for schools in this state. Why say such a thing when in fact it appears that this arrangement benefits just about everyone who would pay property tax in Minnesota?
Well, first of all, the property tax benefits are short-term, and they're spread in a way that we disagree with. But the bottom line is that in terms of new money for the schools, not just shifting who pays for them, but new money for the schools, what the House and the governor have put forward at the beginning of the settlement discussions and even here at the end is inadequate funding for both K-12 and higher education. We believe that as a result of this proposal that the House and the governor have, we're going to have higher class sizes, teacher layoffs, fewer offerings in K-12. We've got double-digit inflation and higher tuition and the very real likelihood that our higher education institutions are going to lose some of their best and top faculty.
Well, your Republican colleagues would say that's probably just not so, that in fact the support is there for K-12 and higher education. What's going to happen in the out years, do you think? And what's going to happen in the short term for schools under this plan? How will they deal with this?
Well, first of all, our Republican colleagues would say that, but it's not unfortunately accurate. Every educational organization in the state of Minnesota had pointed out, even the Senate's budget, which was over $300 million more for education than the governor suggested, was just on the edge of adequate spending. On the out years, I think what we're looking at with the approach taken by the governor and the House is real teacher layoffs, real cuts in classes. And in the long run, the way the House would like to structure the property tax reform and the governor would, many of those costs in the future are going to come back on homeowners without the traditional assistance from the local business communities.
How would that happen? How do you see that happening, sir?
Well, you talked about, in summarizing the agreement that the governor and the House and we agreed to last week, is changing the classification system. Minnesota historically has had a system of classifying property that recognized the value and importance of homeowning. Accordingly, homes had lower classification rates for judging property taxes than did business. And even within homeowners or homes, we had a lower classification rate for those who had low and mid-value homes. That is being changed rather significantly under the tax reform outline that was talked about last week.
Well, sir, why did the Democrats, why did you and the others in the Senate go along with this this agreement if it in fact appears, as you say, to be headed for rather draconian implications for the school districts and for higher education? Why not just dig in your heels and oppose it on principle, let's say?
Well, we do oppose it in principle, but we're not foolish. We're not going to risk the ongoing workings of Minnesota state government. We're not the party of Newt Gingrich. We're the party of responsibility. And we were able to force the House and the governor to come up with some additional funding for higher education and for K-12 education. That was pretty important. We, back on May 16th, outlined a settlement proposal for the budget that is, except for the classification system, exactly what was finally agreed to last Friday. We recognize that the House and the governor have a 2-to-1 advantage over us in terms of the final negotiations, and while we think that Minnesota should be doing better and believe under a Democratic governor, a Democratic House, it would do better, we are not going to shut down government. We're not going to be the Newt Gingriches of Minnesota. We have a responsibility to uphold to the people of the state, and we're going to do that. But we're not going to also stay quiet about what we think the effects are of the House and governor dramatically underfunding education in their original budgets.
Our guest in this hour of midday is Senator John Hottinger, a DFLer from Mankato. Senator Hottinger is Assistant Majority Leader in the Senate. We hope to be joined a little later in this hour by Republican Representative Tim Pawlenty of Eagan, the Majority Leader in the House. We'd like to hear from you as well. If you have a question for Senator Hottinger, you can dial us outside the metro at 1-800-242-2828. That's 800-242-2828. Or in the metropolitan area, the number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Senator, you've been home a couple of days, almost 3 days now, since the announcement of this deal on Friday. What sort of reaction are you getting from your constituents to this?
Well, I think sometimes it's difficult to judge constituent reaction, because usually it's the people who are supportive of you who
right.
come up and talk with you. But certainly I've been stopped, even when I go to restaurants, indicating a frustration that we weren't able to get the House and the governor to come up with some more education funding. I've run into some people who say that while they certainly value the rebate, which we agreed to a long time ago, they would have preferred to see, along with the Senate plan, a little more balanced approach with some investment in transportation and education. All in all, I think most of the people I talked to are pleased we're able to reach an agreement and that we're not going to be prolonging the dispute over our budget up to the point where it causes a crisis in Minnesota.
Were they upset that the House and Senate and the governor, to some degree, did not finish their work in the allotted time?
Actually, not very much. I think people recognize that when you have strongly held views, just as the constituents I represent do, it takes some time to reach an agreement. I think I heard on your news broadcast, or maybe it was in a prior show, a discussion that special sessions are not quite the norm, but are certainly not unusual across the country, especially at a time when we're moving from a strong economy to a weaker economy. Those issues become more focused.
So, yes, and other states are fairly, special sessions are fairly common, but judging by some of the news accounts I read over the weekend in the metropolitan newspapers, informal surveys indicated that the taxpayers were just couldn't, in fact, figure out why, given the amount of time that began in January, the three parties, shall we say, weren't able to come to this sort of agreement earlier.
Well, yeah, I think it's part of the fact that what we do during the legislative session, or at least what we should be doing, is listening to the public and getting their view on the proposal the governor puts out. In the Senate, we did that. We waited and listened and ended up shaping a budget proposal that truly reflected, we believed, what we were hearing from Minnesotans, the balance between tax cuts and making some sound investments in education and transportation and health care. Those decisions, when made, should be based on good information and sometimes result in differences. These are not easy differences to work out. When the House and the governor have been so extraordinarily focused on tax cuts and the Senate has been looking at a different, more balanced approach. So these are firmly held principles that split Minnesotans just as they do the legislature. And sometimes you need to have tough, difficult negotiations to reach some level of agreement.
And I guess having three separate parties doesn't make it any easier either.
Well, that
if you count the
that
governor
does make it harder to find the middle ground when there are three places.
We're joined in this hour of Midday by Representative Dan McElroy, Republican representative from Burnsville. He's the assistant majority leader in the House. Representative McElroy, thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Good morning.
We've been talking to Senator Hottinger about the arrangement reached between the House, Senate, and the governor on Friday. The question for you is, sir, on the whole, this looks like a pretty good deal for anyone who pays property taxes in Minnesota. But what are the long-term implications for this, especially if the economy slows down? Are we not in some way taking a risk with this arrangement?
Not in our opinion. And I think the final agreement reflects that concern. There's about $100 million left in what's called the bottom line, or that functionally gets added to surplus that could account for a downturn. There's also, I think, significant budget reserves that we have built over the last decade, and also the forecasting process is so much better now that there is, there is some room for change. And the numbers, for example, from April were very close to forecast. In the collections were down about $16 million from forecast on a $27-plus billion forecast, $16 million compared to $27 billion. So I think we need to exercise great care, as Senator Hottinger and I often discuss, but this the balance between tax cuts and spending is something about which our bodies and our parties have some deeply held philosophical differences, but I think this final budget negotiation came out reasonably well.
Well, gentlemen, I'd like to ask both of you, what are the chances this tax and spending plan will unravel? Now, you have Democrats in the Senate and Republicans in the House in relative control of their memberships, but how wedded are your members to this agreement, and how do you keep them in line, so to speak, as you go forward in the next few days? Whomever would like to take that first. Senator Hottinger?
Well, let me talk about it from the Senate perspective. As I've indicated, and as we indicated after the budget agreement was reached, we think that the agreement, while keeping state government open, still woefully underfunds public education. I'm hopeful that the Senate Republicans, in alliance with the House Republicans and the governor, will vote strongly for these proposals, because we're going to have some difficulty getting many Democrats to support some of these things. I think I and Senator Moe and others in our caucus need to try and convince Democrats that under the circumstances, this was as far as we could get the House and the governor to move in education, so we should follow through on the basic agreement and keep government operating. But I hope Senate Republicans are supportive, because we're not going to be able to get all the Senate Democrats to support it.
Representative McElroy, will your members go along with this?
We think most of them will. Some of them feel that this deal spends too much money. I think the House and Senate have some of the same problems. We're concerned that we may lose a few votes from our most conservative members. But in general, I think I've been on the phone with a number of our members since last Friday, and the reception is pretty good. I share Senator Hottinger's concern about education, but I also think that we have to work at systemic reforms that allow us to answer the tough questions of how much is enough, how can we provide for a good education and yet leave a spending system in place that our kids can afford to pay for their kids and their grandkids in the future. The mega deal has about $375 million above the forecast for education. There was about $300 million in the forecast for increased spending for schools. So it's about a 7% increase. Compared to most indicators of spending, that's not a small number. But we have had 13 and 15% increases in education the last two bienniums. And it is an expensive system. We cross-subsidize special education with general revenues. Our school funding expectations become more complex in terms of academic subject offerings, discipline challenges. Schools in some cases are the nutrition center for families and for kids. It's not a simple question, and yet in my caucus we're asking the question, how can we fund today's needs but in such a way that our grandkids can pay their taxes?
Representative, I'll put to you the same question I asked Senator Hottinger earlier. What, in the 3 days since this this mega deal, as you described it, was announced, what sort of reaction are you getting from your constituents? Do they, I have to ask, do they understand it, number one? And number two, what is their, are they positive or negative about it generally?
Generally, they're busy enjoying Memorial Day weekend, out with their families. I did get, I think, between Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, about 200 emails. One of them was highly critical. Why didn't you finish your work on time? You should all be taken out and shot. The other 199 were about specific issues. Be sure you take care of metropolitan transit, outstate transit, single sales factor in the tax bill, something, things like that. I haven't had a great deal of concern from my constituents. I was at Target in the grocery store this morning and talked to half a dozen people I know, and they all asked more about tax cuts than about why we didn't get done on time.
Our guest in this hour of midday, our Representative Dan McElroy, he's a Republican from Burnsville, and DFLer Senator John Hottinger of Mankato. Let's go to the phones now, and David in New Brighton, you're on with our representative and our senator.
Yes, I wanted to mentioned that 13-15% increases for education in the last biennium, and that's been welcome and needed since the decade before. It was pretty flat. But in reality, it doesn't pan out that way for the districts. I know in our school district, Mounds View School District, we had $1.3 million of education funding that came in last year. But as far as money of that that carried over to this year, it was only $64,000 that increased, that continued to this year. So that $1.3 million was like a one-shot thing. And it was all targeted to specific things that the school district had to use that were mandated by the legislature. So that is not helping us now, those increases. And in the last decade, you know, there was the net increase when you figure out how all the things get shifted from one source of funding to another. It was about 12% actual increase in funding in the last decade since 1990, and the consumer price index alone in the Twin Cities has gone up 34%. So I'm just quite distressed that we didn't, the legislature didn't take advantage of the surpluses that we had to return our education back to the level that it was. I think it's a short-term, quick fix to give people a rebate, and we're going to pay for it in the long run.
Did you have a specific question, David, for our guests?
Well, is there any way that they're going to be coming back? Is there any possibility of more funding coming up right now, or is this a done deal right now that this is the best it's going to be, and are we just going to have to suck it up and hopefully try and fix something in the next 2 years from now?
Gentlemen, who would like to take that? It looks, I think, from your previous answers, this is in fact a done deal, is it not?
That's correct. This, in terms of the so-called mega budget, this is the amount of money. Now, the interesting question is, where does that money go? And the Republicans are hopeful that most of it will go on the general education formula so it gets to the districts. And I'm sympathetic to this caller's frustration. The taxpayers, in fact, over the 90s, increased spending for education about 40%. It didn't all get to districts like Moundsview, apparently. I know my own district in Burnsville tells me that last year when taxpayer investment went up or taxpayer spending went up 13%, their district got about 8.7% increase for a variety of reasons. And as Senator Hottinger and I have talked before, there is little that I know of that's as complicated as how we fund schools, and it leads to the frustration that some people have. I think we're also in agreement that it's a very high priority.
Senator Hottinger, to return to a previous issue, it sounds like the caller was wishing anyway that there would be some means of tweaking this deal to account to allow for more funding for education. Any chance that the members of the Democratic caucus in the Senate are going to in fact try to push for additional funding once they're back in and meeting later this week?
Well, I think you have to remember where we started from and where we're ending up. At the beginning of, or after the budget bills passed, out of the House and the Senate. The Senate had invested $162 million more than the House did in K-12 education, and $386 million more than the governor wanted to spend in additional K-12 spending for this upcoming biennium. We've pushed both the House and certainly dramatically the governor into a higher level of spending than they wanted to do, and it's still, as I indicated earlier, I think, short of meeting just the adequacy needs for education, given the increased health care costs, increased fuel costs, declining enrollment some area, growing enrollments otherwise. So we've made a dramatic effort to try and increase the governor's woeful underspending and what we thought the House's underspending was. So I don't know that we can push them any further. We'd like to, but I think we've reached about as far as we can push them. As Dan had pointed out, that works out to about a 7% increase in this biennium. And the important word, and it's not listened to very carefully, I'm afraid, is biennium. That's 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 3% and 3%, or 3% and 3.5%. Given the dramatic increases in fuel costs, the growth in pupils, the growth in health care costs, the efforts to try and keep competitive salaries, and the efforts to try and having reduced class sizes, obviously you can't do it with a 3% growth per year in the system.
Let me just weigh in on that.
Yep.
The pupil costs are accounted for in what's called the forecast. This gets a little confusing because both the House and Senate had money for schools in both their education bills and their tax bills. The Senate had a nominal target of $500 million for K-12, had some additional money in the tax bill. The House had a nominal target of $365 million over the forecast and had about $50 million in the tax bill. And so we're somewhat apart. We aren't quite as far apart when you combine all the numbers. And then listeners should remember that in addition to that, there was about $300 million in increased spending provided for in the forecast. But the money we added last year is still there. That wasn't, it may have been for the Mountain View District, but in general, that money was in the base. And so this is an additive process. And we sometimes think of these in terms of investments, but they're investments that are automatically repeated in the following biennium and then increase with inflation. And that's the concern about what our kids can afford in the future.
If you'd like to speak with Representative McElroy or Senator Hottinger, you can reach us at 1-800-242-2828. That's 800-242-2828. That's outside the metro. Or in the metropolitan area, the number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Let's go to Joanne in St. Paul. You're on the air. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
And you had a question for the representative and senator?
Yes, I do. I'm wondering, with this new scheme, I'm just wondering, would the circuit breaker on property tax still apply? Would that aspect of it be retained?
And perhaps one of you could explain the circuit breaker and how that works.
Well, the circuit breaker is a feature of the tax system to help those who have high property taxes in relation to their income. It's available both to homeowners and to renters. It used to be called the renter's credit and the circuit breaker. It's now called the property tax refund. And it is being retained, and in fact it was increased in both the House and Senate. And there's a conference committee going on of the tax bill, and it looks like the circuit breaker that will increase, particularly for homeowners, the maximum amount available will go up from, I believe it's, and don't hold me to these exact numbers there from memory, but I think the maximum today is about $500, and it goes up to $1,000. And then we're still negotiating the renter's credit as to what percentage of rent will be assumed to be taxes. And so the property tax refund or circuit breaker will still be in place, and it will be somewhat enhanced.
And I think that's one of the positive parts. We often hear about the Senate and the House or the Republicans and the Democrats bickering. That's an area where there's pretty common agreement.
That one
provides some property tax-focused relief.
That's correct. And then we also agreed on increasing the working family credit, which is an income tax refund essentially for very low-income working families. It's indexed to the size of families, and it appears that that will increase again this year.
It does seem, gentlemen, as if there is a little bit of something for everyone here if you pay some amount of either property or income taxes in the state of Minnesota. Is that a too general a statement to make?
No, it's particularly a property tax focused proposal this year, and there's few minor things in the income tax, but if you either own property or rent property, you will get some relief this year.
Senator Hottinger?
Well, with the surplus we have, we can do a little bit for everybody, and that's certainly what we're doing, as I've said kind of continually. We aren't doing enough in the area of education, but we're coming down now to the details, as your opening remarks indicated, and how we structure the property tax relief becomes an item that I know Dan's on the tax conference committee. How that conference committee works out, for instance, and the proposals that were put forward by the House and by the Senate on the 24th relating to how to spend the property tax relief. Under the House plan, a homeowner with a $140,000 home would get $328 relief. Under the Senate plan, it would be $640. At $200,000, a house owner, a $200,000 home under the House plan, it would be $754 of relief. Under the Senate plan, it would be $1,252 in relief. Where the changes is once you get to homes over $400,000, the House plan would give more tax relief to those homeowners, and the Senate plan would give somewhat less, but still a couple of $1,000 of relief.
You're listening to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. Gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll return with more talk about the tax and spending plan and the legislative session.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Twin Cities Business Monthly, the magazine of Minnesota business.
I'm Melinda Pencava. This year marks the 60th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Why is World War II unique in the way it inspires thoughts of patriotism and loyalty to a cause? Join me on Memorial Day to share memories of World War II. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That's today at 1 o'clock on Minnesota Public Radio. And you are listening to member-supported Minnesota Public Radio, thanks to our loyal and generous members. You are listening to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Mike Edgerly, in today for Gary Eichten. A reminder that coming up at noon today, it's a Commonplace Memorial Day special, a program that will explore the subject of healing after the devastation of war, two stories of sacrifice, loss, and reconciliation. That's a Commonplace Memorial Day special coming up at noon today on Midday, and Gary Eichten will return tomorrow. In this hour of Midday, we're talking about the tax and spending agreement that was put in place last Friday by the House, the Senate, and Governor Jesse Ventura. And our guest in this hour are our Senator John Hottinger and Representative Dan McElroy. Representative McElroy is a Republican from Burnsville, and Senator Hottinger is a DFLer from Mankato. Gentlemen, we were talking just before that break about detail. For those of us on the outside of the Capitol, how much actually remains to be done before this arrangement Friday is actually in concrete and can be voted on by the members of both chambers?
Let me start that, and then John can add his point of view. There are 8 major bills that need to be negotiated, a tax bill, a bonding bill, and then 6 large spending bills. Those spending bills probably average 500 pages in length. They deal with literally hundreds, or in a couple cases maybe 1,000 detailed decisions. It's a lot of work to put one together, and they have to be put together so they follow the outline of the big picture budget deal, so they take care of the needs of the agencies and the customers, the citizens that need service, and so that they meet something called the tails budget. We now, one of the things that's greatly improved our budgeting process is we budget for 2 years, but we plan also for the following 2 years, and you have to stay within budget for what's called the tails period. If all the conference committees are able to start back to work tomorrow, we've been telling the leadership in the House that 3 or 4 days we'll probably get the work done. The question is coming to agreement. There may be a couple of areas where it's harder to come to agreement, but there is a date by which property tax rates need to be set in order for these changes to take effect for next year, and that's June 11th. And so I'm hopeful we can hold the special session on or before June 11th. And I think it's realistic to think the work can get done within that time pretty easily.
Senator Hottinger, that still seems like quite a bit of a crunch for all that has to be done.
Well, I would agree with Dan that the time frame he's outlined is one that we strongly want to emphasize with our conferees that they abide by. We've got 4 days in the coming week for these conference committees to meet to make decisions on how the money within each of their bills is being spent and some of the policy implications of those. Some of the committees have been working. I know Dan is a chief negotiator for the House on economic development area, and I think he's been working with the Senate chair. We've been a little frustrated that since May 16th we've had these budget targets as part of the Senate proposal and haven't been able to work in some of those areas as much as they could. But some of the larger bills, health and human services, I know that Senator Berkeland has pushed hard to have that conference committee deal with a number of those issues. I think probably the most complicated one will be the details in the tax bill. Dan's on that conference committee. I have been in the past and am not this year. Missed the opportunity to be with Dan because he's always a very helpful and good negotiator. But it's a task, but I think we have the responsibility to get it done, and I hope our conferees get down to work and get those final details worked out.
I want to go back to the phones in just a second, but I have to ask both of you gentlemen, what is the working relationship like now between the House and the Senate? Is it friendly? Is it adversarial? Could each of you take a run at that and describe for our listeners what it's like in this type of probably a pressurized situation, politically so? What's it like working together? Are you able to get along?
Well, let me take the first run at that. First of all, I was pretty closely involved in the negotiations with the governor's office, and even though we had different goals and different values that we were advocating for, at a personal level, those negotiations are conducted in a professional and businesslike manner, with the possible exception of the governor's public comments. But I think that's also the way it generally is in conference committees, especially now that they have the broad outlines that have been agreed to. I know, as I said, having worked with Dan and the tax committee in the past, that now we can get down to a thoughtful policy discussion and acknowledgement of where this has to end up in a few days and get it done professionally. We are, after all, have the public's interests we all share. And I have always found, with very few exceptions, that the actual negotiations and discussion between the House and the Senate are conducted with dignity and respect and professionalism.
Representative McElroy?
I agree. There is a level of professionalism and collegiality that works 95% of the time. Once in a while, like any endeavor with human beings, you're going to have a blow-up or tempers will flare. But it doesn't happen very often, and I think the taxpayers are pretty well served in the process.
Let's go back.
I do think it would be appropriate at some time to talk about the governor's call for a unicameral, and he uses as evidence of the need for a unicameral the fact that the negotiations broke down. I'm grateful every day for the bicameral system because the bills that we end up with are better in the details because of the sort of three-phase process, separate look in the House, a separate look in the Senate, and then a collegial review and conference committee. And I hate to think that we would have passed bills that were only went through one review process.
Let's go back to the phones. Tom in St. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. All this session and on this show, I haven't heard anything about very important environmental initiatives that are going to be cut back or eliminated by actions of the House. Specifically, there's a county biological survey that's half done that its budget's going to be cut in half. There's a Forest Songbird initiative that is in its final year of a 12-year survey, and that's going to be completely eliminated, as well a mussel survey that's half done with the state that is going to be completely eliminated if the House has its way. I'd be curious to hear what the representative has to say about that.
Representative McElroy?
It's interesting. Those were also proposals of the governor at the beginning of the biennium. And in general, we've heard very little about that from the public. I think I've had a total of 2 emails or phone calls about those issues. I don't serve on those committees, so I'm not quite as knowledgeable about them as I would like to be. But as I understand it, they each have a history about how long the funding was supposed to last, how long the project was supposed to last. And I would also just kind of caution or encourage the caller, those are decisions that finally will be made in conference committee. And it isn't just a question of the House or the Senate getting their way. It's a question of experienced people on both sides of the aisle and from both bodies trying to come to a balance with the amount of money available. And the Environment Committee had a target fairly substantially above what the House came out with, as I recall, or somewhat above it. And so if the evidence is strong that these are needed programs, the conference committee may still be able to fund them.
Well, I unfortunately, the Environmental Agriculture Conference Committee was given their targets last week, and they were far below what the Senate proposal was. In an effort to try and get the House to move upwards in K-12 and higher education, I'm afraid that some of the environmental potential funding was lost. The caller talked about a variety of programs. I know I carried a bill to try and get some additional funding for research relating to the frogs, which has become a very interesting and, more important, a very valuable area of research that wasn't able to survive. But even more fundamentally, the funding from the House has some real potential risk for the funding for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We may be able to provide adequate funding, or at least sustenance funding, with the low budget target, but it's going to be difficult.
Well, I don't agree that $16 million above the base is necessarily low, and the base, as it does in all cases, has adjustments from previous year's actual spending. But callers have to wonder that in comparison to funding K-12 education or higher education or nursing homes or making us more competitive in the tax area, if priorities have to be set. And I'm not sure my constituents would say that a survey of rare exotic mussels in the rivers and lakes of Minnesota rises to the same priority as education.
And the question is whether it rises to the same priority of exceptional tax relief for the business community and exceptional tax relief for homeowners with homes over $500,000. It isn't necessarily balancing the environment against education. It's balancing the environment against the levels of tax cuts that we provide.
Let's go back to the phones. Bill, you're on the air with our representative and our senator.
Good morning. I haven't heard much in recent weeks since the K-12 education bill was settled about the status of compensatory education funding, which particularly helps the urban districts. I'd like to know what the status of it is and also what the policy concepts are behind each position.
Who would like to take that?
Well, I can start, and then this may be one where John and I disagree. The House is concerned about the accountability in the compensatory program. Compensatory, for listeners who may not be familiar with it, is a program that funnels more money per pupil to districts with more poor families and with concentrations of poor families. It works along with programs like Federal Title I and Assurance of Mastery to try and bring up the performance of those who are one or more grade levels behind an expected performance. It's a funding of about $500 million a biennium. That's a mixture of state and federal funds. There was an extensive audit. In fact, there have been two audits of the program, one by the legislative auditor and one by the state auditor in the last few years, that call into question how good a value the taxpayers get for their money. The House proposal was to change the name of the program from compensatory to remedial, to take away one of the projected uses. There are about 12 uses of the money listed in the law, and the last one is all other uses deemed appropriate, which at times has been abused, not often. Certainly people of good intention making decisions, but try to focus the use of the money a little more and set what we call a sunset or an automatic review of the program in 6 years. And then the original proposal also reduced the amount of money going to the high concentration issue districts. And the caller indicated it goes mostly to metropolitan districts. It goes principally to Minneapolis and St. Paul, mm-hmm. and then to some districts that have special characteristics where they need the help. But just as an example, the average district in the state gets somewhere between $6,000 and $7,000 per student in state funding. The highest compensatory districts get something over $12,000 per student. And it certainly has been a program with some controversy. the bottom line in conference committee, I think, will be that hopefully there'll be some additional accountability and that all other miscellaneous use will be negotiated. I don't expect the amount of money to change from the current program.
Senator Hottinger?
Well, I think Dan outlined part of the differences. Compensatory revenue, which is to help focus in districts of high poverty where there's plenty of indication that additional financing is very necessary if we want to give every child in Minnesota an opportunity to succeed, would be the indexing of it is, that is, the automatic increases were eliminated by the House and they changed the name of it, looking towards a phase-out of that funding. That wasn't acceptable to the Senate, and while we phase in the new increases in terms of compensatory revenues, we believe strongly that we need to provide some assistance in those areas with high concentrations of poverty. It does provide children with better opportunities to succeed, which should be our first goal. The remaining issue, as I understand it, is in the large big plan settlement.
Mm-hmm.
There are issues related to whether or not the compensatory revenue is tied at all to the increases in education funding, and the Senate feels strongly, and we believe it was part of that agreement, that that linkage should remain.
Let's go back to the phone. Steve and Holly, you're on with our guest.
Yes, thank you very much. I have several comments and concerns about the K-12 funding. I definitely agree with the previous caller who brought up the gap we have between the increased funding for education and the actual CPI. We're still behind the CPI, and that's a concern. I happen to live in a small district where we've had some of the best results on the grad standard tests in the state. We get there through a combination of teachers, paraprofessionals, and volunteers, parents who come in. We have a parent, for example, who spends every day, all day, in the school assisting the teachers, reading to students, and helping them. So I think there's a notion sometimes that, well, we can always cover these fund cuts by getting volunteers. My point is we're already doing that, and I don't know if we can tap additional volunteers to make up shortfalls. We will, in fact, cut paraprofessionals who assist in our reading program this year, even with the increased funding. That's simply a fact. Two other points that I'd like to make.
Try to make them quickly, please. We're running out of time.
Two other points for the conferees. Governor Ventura has generally talked about a free market philosophy, and yet he seems to reject that analysis at all when he criticizes schools for paying competitive salaries to get teachers in the especially difficult areas such as science and math. And that would be my last comment.
Thank you for calling. Representative McElroy, at the top of this program, I think before you had joined us, we were discussing Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe's comments that, in fact, this arrangement is going to lead directly to layoffs, and this caller seems to echo that sentiment. What's your reaction to that, and do you agree that, in fact, this budget agreement will, in fact, lead to a loss of personnel at districts around the state?
In some schools, it may, and the question is that inevitable given declining enrollments in some districts, and you know, changes in decisions that we have made. In the school district that the caller teaches in, he may be correct that their increases haven't kept up with inflation. What the taxpayers have invested, however, is about 10% over inflation in the 90s. Education isn't the only area where spending has needed to increase substantially. Some of your listeners are old enough to remember Harold Levander, mm-hmm. who cried in 1969 when he introduced the state's first biennial budget of $1 billion. If that had increased only for inflation, spending today would be about $8 billion, and it is, in fact, $27 billion. And we're fortunate enough we've been able to afford to spend that. The personal income in Minnesota has grown dramatically. But the state economist tells us that for the state, you know, to keep things the status quo, if the spending grows as fast in the next 30 years, it has in the last 30 years, spending per capita in 2030 will be about $54,000 per person. And incomes in 2030, the average per capita income in the state would have to be $500,000 for state spending to be the same percentage of personal income it is today. And I worry about that. I hope that happens, but I'm concerned that it may not happen. And we also look at our tax system, and I know Senator Hottinger is critical of the fact that we want to provide tax relief to all Minnesotans. But in the property tax system, we rank about 30th in the nation for low-value homes and first, second, or third in the nation, depending on how you measure, in high-value homes. And it makes for a complicated discussion or a complicated debate among people who care deeply about policy, not just for today, but for many generations to come.
Senator Hottinger, would you like to respond to that, please?
Well, I think I want to correct a misstatement by Dan. The Senate tax plan has always provided relief for all Minnesotans. But the House tax plan, as put forward a couple of days ago, gives $6,433 of tax cuts for someone with a $1 million home, and the Senate plan gives $4,690 million of tax cuts. So we're providing plenty of tax relief, Dan, across the board. We just think that low and middle income people have the greatest needs. So in the tax approach that we have, I think both sides want to give all Minnesotans some tax relief. We just think it's low and mid-income homeowners who need it a little bit more. And fortunately, we're not making decisions for 30 years. We're making decisions for 2 years. If you look back the past 10 years, as one of your callers indicated, we have not kept up with the education needs of our students. When you look at projected growth in personal income next to projected growth in state spending, if it continues at the same level, we'll be making $1 million a year. So $500,000 is easily attainable. That's the silliness of looking at long-term numbers. We have to make two-year decisions. And in the next 2 years, we're underfunding education dramatically under the governor's proposal, significantly under the House proposal, and we're not funding it even adequately under what this agreement ended up being.
Representative McElroy, I think you get the last comment as we
run out of time. Well, I think we have to look seven generations out. I'll have to send my friend Senator Hottinger a copy of Sitting Bull's autobiography in which he talked about the longtime tradition of Native American peoples of thinking seven generations in advance, because the decisions we make today have implications for many generations to come. And they have to be things not only that we can afford today, but that our grandkids can afford.
Thank you, sir. Thank you both for joining us today. We've been listening to Representative Dan McElroy, a Republican of Burnsville, and Senator John Hottinger, a DFLer from Mankato, talking about the budget agreement reached with the governor last Friday and which will still be a source of negotiations beginning tomorrow.
Most stray dogs roaming in the Cass Lake area are only a nuisance, but last month a woman was viciously attacked near the Leech Lake Indian Reservation.
I knew at that point that I probably wasn't, this was it, I was gonna die. And I don't know if you ever experienced anything like that, but I just knew that this was it.
I'm Greta Cunningham. We'll have that story on the next All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 28th of May, 2001. Memorial Day, observed in the United States since 1869. For the purpose of strewing flowers or decorating the graves of comrades who died in defense of their country in the Civil War. It's the birthday of the novelist Meg Wolitzer, born in Brooklyn, 1959. First novel came out when she was just 23, Sleepwalking, story of three teenage girls who suffer from anorexia and depression. She wrote a novel, This Is Your Life, that was made into a movie by Nora Ephron, and Wolitzer then wrote a book about making the movie about her book called Fitzgerald Did It, The Writer's Guide to Mastering the Screenplay. It's the birthday of the novelist Maeve Binchy, born in Dalkey, a small village outside of Dublin, in 1940. She was a writer for the Irish Times for many years before she started writing fiction and plays. Perhaps best known for her novels Light a Penny Candle, Circle of Friends, The Glass Lake, and Tara Road. Maeve Binchy, who said, I don't think that anyone is dull. I could sit forever in a shopping mall or an airport just watching people. There's a story in everyone, a hope, a dream, a disappointment. It's the birthday of the poet Mae Swenson, born in Logan, Utah, 1919, the oldest of 10 children born to Swedish immigrants who converted to Mormonism. It's the birthday of novelist Walker Percy in Birmingham, Alabama, 1916, best known for his novel The Moviegoer, which was also his first novel. It's the birthday of the man who created James Bond, Ian Fleming, born in London, 1908. When he was 31, he joined British Naval Intelligence and spent the years during World War II plotting intelligence operations, some of which later wound up in his spy fiction. His first spy thriller was Casino Royale, published in 1953, starring the British spy, the stylish James Bond. It's the birthday of the naturalist and geologist Louis Agassiz, born in Moutier, Switzerland, 1807. Moved to the United States when he was 39 to accept a professorship at Harvard, where he founded the Museum of Comparative Zoology. He was a great teacher who encouraged his students to learn from direct contact with nature instead of through books and lectures. And it was on this day in 585 BC, a total eclipse of the sun caused the Lydians and the Medes, who were at war in what is now Turkey, to call a ceasefire and negotiate peace. Here's a poem for today by Robert Bly, The Eel in the Cave. Our veins are open to shadow, and our fingertips porous to murder. It's only the inattention of the prosecutors that lets us go to lunch. Reading my old letters, I notice a secret will. It's as if another person had planned my life. Even in the dark, someone is hitching the horses. That doesn't mean I have done things well. I have found so many ways to disgrace myself and throw a dark cloth over my head. Why is it our fault if we fall into desire? The eel, poking his head from his undersea cave, entices the tiny soul falling out of heaven. So many invisible angels work to keep us from drowning. So many hands reach down to pull the swimmer from the water. Even though the district attorney keeps me well in mind, grace allows me sometimes to slip into the Alhambra by night. A poem by Robert Bly, The Eel in the Cave, from the collection The Night Abraham Called to the Stars, published by HarperCollins, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, brought to you by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find 13 million gently read classics, bestsellers, and rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.
You're listening to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Mike Edgerly. Gary Eichten returns tomorrow. Coming up at noon today, it's a commonplace Memorial Day special. That's coming up right after station identification.
Conference committees reconvene at the state capitol to work out the details of last week's budget deal. I'm Kathy Worzer. A preview tomorrow on Morning Edition from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNWFM 91.1.
This is Minnesota Public Radio. We have sunny skies, 72 degrees at KNOW-FM, 91.1 Minneapolis-St. Paul. Twin Cities weather for this afternoon, mostly sunny skies, warmer temperatures, the high around 75. Clear skies tonight, the low in the 40s. Tomorrow, more sun, more warmth, the high tomorrow reaching 75 degrees.